Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we are going to be talking about the Alex Jones controversy with Megyn Kelly, what that whole debacle was, and also about the media doing that to personalities in general and how you can manage that. They record 10 hours of conversation and then turn it into 10 minutes, make themselves look as good as possible, and then fit you to whatever narrative they were trying to do. So you have to be careful on what that narrative is. So we're going to talk about that and how personalities really need to manage that and what they should do. And then we're going to talk about with Michael Schneider, the man from the Economics Collapse blog, we're going to talk about the economic depression that he sees, the economic collapse that he sees, and what he means by economic collapse, and whether a full-blown one is possible in the future or whether it's just kind of a long-term decline of the United States. We're going to talk about the Fed. We're going to talk about the dollar. We're going to talk about all the issues behind this collapse, he calls it, and we're going to talk about that stuff. We're also going to talk about Congress. He is thinking about running for Congress, so he's going to start talking about that. We'll dive more into that in part two. This is part one of my interview with him, so part two will get exciting when he starts talking about whether he'll run for Congress or not. But let's get into that conversation now with Michael Schneider.
Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for having me on again. It's been a while. It's such a thrill to be back on the show.
Well, let's talk about how much you have going on. I see your name all over the place. You have been very active covering many topics. Now you have three different blogs that you do, and you also have a video series, but you're also a regular contributor to InfoWars, and you have been interviewed several times by Alex Jones. So I want to cover kind of the big media thing that's gone on lately and see what your opinion is. Knowing him through your work and the several interviews that you've had, what do you think of the recent run-in with him and Megyn Kelly?
Well, I think it shows the kind of the clash of opposing worldviews where you've got the mainstream media. And the mainstream media is basically dominated by six giant corporations, which own cable networks, the big, ABC, NBC, CBS, they own publishing houses. Basically more than 90% of what we get through our television comes from one of these big media corporations, which in turn are owned by the elite of the world. And wherever you turn, yeah, maybe some are more Republican or Democrat or whatever, but at the end of the day, they all adhere to a certain liberal orthodoxy, kind of the dominant worldview in our society today. And they're used to being kind of the dominant force or the gatekeepers especially before the internet. They were the gatekeepers of information and news and what people were going to hear and be fed informationally in our society. And so now with the internet and with the alternative media and people like Alex Jones rising up, now all of a sudden, millions of people are listening to Alex Jones. And in my opinion, he was quite a factor in the race for the presidency, turning a lot of people to Trump, very enthusiastically promoting him. And so if you take Alex Jones out of the equation, I don't believe we would have a President Trump. And so the mainstream media all of a sudden is saying, hey, this isn't supposed to happen, because the mainstream media, of course, was trying to bury Trump. Negative stories constantly every day. And so when that happened, it kind of what set off an alarm for them saying, hey, our monopoly over news and information and what people are supposed to think is being broken. And so there's been scrutiny on him, certainly, and on a much smaller scale, I feel it on myself, because we are independent thinkers. We don't go along necessarily with the dominant liberal orthodoxy of the day. And we've gotten big enough as the alternative media as a whole where they feel threatened. And so they've come out with this big thing about fake news. Have you heard that term? And there is real fake news out there where there's some websites they purposely put out false stories that sound outrageous, but just to get people to come and click on their ads. And so there is that, but that's relatively small. But really, when they've used that fake news label for people like Alex Jones, people like, you know, Hagman, people like me, people in the alternative media that are not part of the establishment media, they want to smear us by calling us fake news. And they, you know, before Trump won, we were kind of an annoyance, but now they consider us kind of a major threat because of what we've been able to achieve and the number of listeners we've been able to garner, you know, and the number, you know, the number of people that read my websites and my articles on all the websites, they appear on all over the internet every day from my little home here in Idaho. It blows me away because me and my wife were just up here in the mountains of Idaho, just two ordinary people. But the internet has allowed just ordinary people to have a dramatic impact on society. And ultimately, we hear from people all over the world who are exposed to our work, which, I mean, amazes me to this day. So I think ultimately, when you have the two come, that Megyn Kelly, when she wants to interview Alex Jones, and there's this violent backlash by the establishment, by the liberal orthodoxy, because they don't want him, they don't want to hear from him. They don't want him to be legitimized in any way in their eyes. And then on the other side, Alex Jones, you know, he was deeply suspicious of Megyn Kelly because he thought, well, she's going to do a hit piece, which she kind of did. And so what we saw was this clash of these two really opposing forces, because the establishment media and the establishment media and the alternative media really, Sarah, are essentially at almost in a state of war.
They kind of are. It's really, really interesting. One thing that I thought was interesting, and I heard other people complain about this a lot, is they'll do hours upon hours of recording to find that one little snippet to make you look bad. And they did it to Alex Jones, but I've heard other people complain about this as well. They don't like those short-term, short-format videos and things because they just can't talk about stuff, and they end up looking really bad. And so it kind of brought that to the spotlight as well, that NBC isn't really covering things in depth. They're just picking and choosing what they want and making people look however they want. I don't know why anybody would go on that, put themselves through that.
Yeah, it's a legitimate question. I mean, I tuned in for the interview on NBC that night because I wanted to watch it. And I expected it to take up most of the hour, you know, because, hey, this big interview, it's been in the news. I expected it. But instead, it was only a limited part of the show. And like you said, they had done so much taping, so much interviewing. But then they pick out because they want to frame things a certain way. They interview and interview, but they want those little nuggets, those little sound bites to make people look bad. And ultimately, they want to make people like Alex Jones look bad. They want to make people like me look bad. And so, as we'll talk about later in the show, I'm going to be in a position not only to be interviewed more by the alternative media, but by mainstream news outlets moving forward. So there's a dilemma. Some people in my situation would reject those types of interviews because they don't want to be made to look bad. But on the other hand, you have someone like Donald Trump. And what was, you know, even though the mainstream media hated him, Trump was constantly on CNN. He was constantly on the big news shows, you know, 60 Minutes. Basically, whoever wanted to interview him, he was there. Even though they were against him, he knew that he could get his message out through the media. And it worked. You can't say that it didn't work for Trump.
But he had to use a lot of alternative sources to get his message out. Because if he just relied on that, he relied on that to get exposure. But he had to have other messages coming out. Otherwise, that would have just buried him.
Oh, it's true. You know, if it was only the mainstream media, they could have kind of controlled the narrative. And that's why he's taken to Twitter to get his message out directly. And that's why, you know, Trump appeared on the Alex Jones show. He appeared on a whole host of alternative and conservative outlets. And so, yeah. So if we were in the old days where the mainstream media had a monopoly and could completely control the narrative, it wouldn't have gone so well for Trump. But Trump wanted that exposure in the mainstream media. But then also he had many other ways to get his message out.
I almost think if you have many other ways to get your message out, that's smart. But then you have to think strategically. Okay, if you don't have that, okay, what is your agenda with me? What is the narrative you're going to put me in? And if you don't approve of that narrative, then do not go on that show. And then you got to trust whether they're going to do the narrative they claim they're going to do. And that's where you have to, you know, you just have to be really worried about, you have to be careful about the narrative that they're going to put you in and make sure that narrative aligns with what you're strategically trying to do. And if not, you have enough other sources to be able to control the conversation.
Yeah, and that's what we all need to understand, whether we're on these shows or whether we're just watching them. Because sometimes, you know, no news network, no television station, no radio show is just there to look out for the best interest of the consumers or the voters or whatever. Everybody has an agenda. Everybody does. And everyone's trying to push a particular point of view, their worldview, the way they see the world. That includes ABC, CBS, NBC, everybody. And once you understand that, you don't just sit there and take in news and information unfiltered. It's imperative in our day and time to think critically. And they don't teach you how to do this in school anymore. And, you know, public education. I came up through public education all my life, all the way up through university, all the way through law school. I went to public schools. And our system of public education is horrible. And one thing they don't teach you to do is how to think critically, but we've got to learn how to do that, to think critically, to think for ourselves, because if we let someone else do our thinking for us, we're going to get in big trouble.
Absolutely. No matter what side of the spectrum you're on, you need to be able to think critically.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's why I'm so thankful for the alternative media of which I'm a part, in that we're providing another point of view. And, you know, maybe you agree or you disagree, but at least you're getting more sides of the story, and you're not just getting one side of the story from the corporate controlled media and saying, okay, this is what you're supposed to think. You know, I'm a big believer in the marketplace of ideas. Let's get all the ideas out there. Let's get all the points of view. And maybe that's part of my legal training, but, you know, one side of the case is going to sound really good if that's all you hear. But if you hear all the sides, all the points of view, well, then, you know, let's just see who wins in the marketplace of ideas.
Yeah, that's how you really get to the truth and figuring things out, is get it all out there. Well, okay, so let's move on to your coverage of the economy, because you've been really covering this in depth since 2008. And one of your blogs is called the Economics Collapse Blog, right? I don't know if you have a blog in the name. Is it the Economic Collapse or the Economics Collapse Blog?
Well, the website address is theeconomiccollapseblog.com.
That's what I thought. Okay, but you focus on the collapse since 2008, but you don't really take collapse to mean in the traditional sense, because we obviously haven't had a collapse, but I've read some of your articles talk about it in a more broader sense. What do you mean by an economic collapse?
Well, I mean a couple of things, Sarah. A lot of people, they talk about it like it's some big Hollywood movie or event that's coming up, that's going to happen all of a sudden, then it'll be over, and then we're going to rebuild. But I talk about it in a much broader sense, in that at one time, the U.S. economy was the envy of the world. It was the greatest economic machine the world had ever seen. And you had cities like Detroit, Michigan, which at one time had the highest per capita income in the entire country, the greatest manufacturing city the world had ever seen. But today, when you look at Detroit, and it looks like almost a third world country, thousands of abandoned buildings, manufacturing has fled, immense poverty. Today they run news stories about Detroit all over the world as a joke, look at what's happened to America. When I talk about economic collapse, one thing I'm referring to is our long-term economic decline, where once upon a time, the United States lent out more money than anyone else in the world. Now we owe more money than the rest of the world. We're $20 trillion in debt. That's just the federal government. Then you've got state, local governments. Corporate debt has doubled since the last financial crisis. Consumers are more than $12 trillion in debt. And, you know, so, and that as our, you know, because we've seen manufacturing, tens of thousands of manufacturing facilities shut down all over the country, millions of good paying jobs leaving the country, going to the other side of the world. And so many Americans today, well, they've got to work at Walmart or different service jobs because the good paying jobs aren't there anymore. The middle class is shrinking. You know, in 2015, the middle class became a minority of the population for the first time ever. That was a key turning point, in my opinion. And so, you know, all these slow and economic decline. And then the only way we've been able to maintain our standard of living is by going into all of this debt. You know, it's just like, you know, personally, if, say, you lost a job, had to take a much lower paying job, and but then you wanted to keep up your standard of living, well, you could, you know, put it on your credit cards, you know, buy a new car, you know, get an auto loan, all these things, get a house you couldn't afford. But eventually it catches up with you. And that's as our economy has declined. That's what we've been able to do, maintain our standard of living with all this debt. It's a debt-fueled standard of living, but you can't do that forever. You can't have debt expand far, far, far faster than your economy is growing forever. Eventually, as we've seen in so many cases, whether it's Greece, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's Italy right now, I mean, the list goes on, Zimbabwe, the list goes on and on and on. It catches up with you in a major way eventually. And so we've seen this long-term economic decline in our country. Now, I do believe that it is going to accelerate as we move into the future because we're going to pay a great price for all this debt, all these foolish decisions, losing our economic infrastructure, losing our manufacturing. Because if you want to be a great economy, if you want to be a wealthy nation, you can't just consume stuff. You've got to make stuff. You've got to build stuff. You've got to create wealth instead of just consuming it. And so, see, we were very good at consuming it, but, you know, we've got to create it, you know, so we make up the difference with debt. But anyway, so we're moving into this future, $20 trillion in debt, that's just on the federal level. You know, we're already seeing like the state of Illinois, the biggest financial crisis they've ever gone through, all these things. And so I do believe it's going to get worse. We're going to see more events like 2008, Sarah, and we're going to see moments of great panic. But in general, and this is a very long-winded answer, I know, but in general, I am referring to this process that's been going on literally for decades, but that will accelerate as we move forward.
So do you think, I mean, obviously we haven't had the full-blown collapse that you know, the Hollywood movie thing, but could that happen? Could that come where it is more of that, or could they kind of muddle around and then replace the dollar and we just kind of keep going?
Well, Sarah, I mean, I truly believe that we would have seen things a lot worse if they had not interfered so much. Because since the 2008, we've seen intervention by the central banks and by the federal government that is unprecedented in our history. And if they wouldn't have done all this intervention, we would be in a rip-roaring depression right now. But by doing this, they've made our long-term problems even worse. Let me try to explain. You know, for example, the Obama administration, during the, you know, when Barack Obama entered office, we were $10.6 trillion in debt on the federal level. Now we're almost $20 trillion. So we had more than $9 trillion of debt during the Obama era. Now that's taking $9 trillion of consumption from the future and bringing it into the present. So the federal government injected $9 trillion into the economy that wouldn't have been there if we wouldn't have stolen that money from future generations of Americans. And of course, once the federal government spends that money into the economy, gets into people's pockets, and they spend it on things they need, food and clothing and housing, et cetera. So there's a multiplying effect to government spending. And so we've added, if you take that, even if you just don't want to ignore the multiplying effect and take $9 trillion out of the economy over the past 8 years, I mean, like I said, that alone would have plunged our economic growth into a rip-roaring, you know, economic depression right there, that alone. Okay, then you look at the Federal Reserve with quantitative easing, pumping trillions of dollars of hot money into the financial system, made this enormous stock bubble, which we see today. And people say, oh, the stock market's at all-time record highs, that the economy must be doing well. Well, the economy is not doing well, as we'll talk about in a little bit, because there's been this incredible disconnect between the real economy, which is, you know, basically a no-growth economy, middle class is shrinking, and the stock market, where people are making lots of money because of the Federal Reserve injecting all this money. And Sarah, it's not just the Federal Reserve. It's other central banks, too. In fact, global central banks overall are on pace to buy $3.6 trillion worth of stocks and bonds this year alone. Wow. And a lot of that money, even from foreign central banks, is coming into our financial system. For example, the Swiss National Bank, the Central Bank of Switzerland, during January, February, and March, Sarah, they bought 4 million shares of Apple Computer, in just those 3 months. I mean, so, you know, if you and I, you know, whatever effect we have in the market buying and selling Apple, that is absolutely swamped by the Swiss Central Bank coming in and buying 4 million shares. You know, so, you know,
do they own the majority shares then of most of these corporations?
Well, with the Swiss National Bank in Facebook, the Swiss National Bank actually owns more publicly traded shares of Facebook than Mark Zuckerberg does, which, you know, is incredible. Now, Mark Zuckerberg still has other types of shares in Facebook that give him control. But in terms of the shares that are publicly traded on the markets today, the Swiss National Bank has more of those shares than Mark Zuckerberg does, which is incredible. You know, or you look at Japan, and the Bank of Japan has just been shameless in buying up stocks and bonds there. In fact, at the current rate, the Bank of Japan is going to be the number one shareholder in 55 different of the largest companies in Japan by the end of next year. You know, so because they've just been and they're already in the top five in more than 80 of those companies. So, you know, it's like these central banks are just buying up everything. And if they keep this up, if they were to keep this up indefinitely, eventually, well, they're going to own just about everything because they're just buying and buying and buying. And this is what's driven up stock prices. But now, well, for example, the Federal Reserve now says, well, now we're going to raise interest rates and we're going to start to unwind our balance sheet. Well, what that does is that the central banks have been the primary driver of driving these stock prices up to all-time record highs. So what happens when they start reversing the process? Well, then we see, you know, instead of stocks going up, then they go down. And, you know, and this could be very bad for Trump. And I hope there's not any political motivations behind what the Fed is doing, because during the Obama era, of course, interest rates were driven all the way to the floor, which is good for economic activity. And they injected all this money into the financial system, which was great for the stock market. But now the Federal Reserve, hey, they just raised interest rates again. Now they're saying, hey, we want to unwind our balance sheet. Is that going to reverse the process and be bad for Trump? Are they trying to hurt Trump? I don't know. But without a doubt, it's not going to be good for Trump.
Well, what happens if they start unwinding? What's going to happen to the average person? What's it going to feel like when they, is it going to be a roaring depression? Or do you think they can control it to keep us, you know, kind of muddle along and be not great, but not a roaring depression?
Well, I guess that would be the best case scenario. But Sarah, you know, when you look back throughout history, you know, every great stock market bubble, you know, whether 1929, 1987, the dot-com bubble, 2008, whenever we've seen price earnings ratios get this high, whenever we've seen margin debt get, you know, get this dramatic, whenever we've seen, you know, a huge stock market bubble, which we're in a historic one today, they've always ended badly. We've never had one that's ended well. So could they manage and muddle us through this one? I guess it's possible, but I'm not particularly optimistic, because what happens is markets tend to go down a lot faster than they go up. And like we saw in 2008, when fear and panic start setting in and markets start going down, things can start falling very, very rapidly. And what happens is, for example, and it's just a domino effect. I mean, you look at pension funds. Already we've got pension funds in crisis all over the nation. And what's happened, pension funds used to be very conservative in the old days, but now in our days, they're so starved to get a return that they've been just flooding into the stock markets, into equity markets, trying to get a return for, you know, to, because that's what they need to fulfill their obligations in the future, because they can't get a return because interest rates were so low, they couldn't get a return with, you know, some of the traditional safer investments. So they flooded into stocks. And so with their projections and the obligations they need to meet, well, they're barely, so many of them are in crisis already all over the country. But if the stock market were to fall by even 10 or 20%, I mean, that would just be a nightmare for pension funds all over the country. If stocks were to fall 40 or 50%, I mean, we would be talking about a pension apocalypse. And really, Sarah, we, in order for stocks to get back to the levels where they make sense, where price earnings ratios make sense in terms of their long-term historical averages, that's what we need. We need a decline of about at least 40 or 50% just to get back to normal, where stock prices are rational again. But if that happens, I mean, it's going to be such a bigger nightmare than 2008. I mean, it's not even going to be worth comparing.
So what should people do? Should we have gold and silver, or should we have cash sitting there? I mean, what are people going to do?
Well, what I like to do is remind people of 2008. What happened? All of a sudden, the financial markets started crashing, and millions of people, I mean, millions of people started losing their jobs really, really rapidly. And businesses started to go under, and a lot of people started hurting really quickly. But what happened is, because about two-thirds of the country back then, or more than 60%, were living paycheck to paycheck, they didn't have anything to fall back on. So all of a sudden they couldn't pay the mortgage, and we saw mortgage defaults and foreclosures go crazy, right? Remember that? Mm-hmm. And also all of a sudden people, they lost their job, they couldn't pay their mortgage, then they're out on the street. They went from being living a middle class lifestyle to all of a sudden, hey, you know, everything's gone. So I'm a big believer in having an emergency fund of at least 6 months. So if you lose your job, your business has a downturn, whatever, you've got something to fall back on. So I strongly urge my readers all the time, hey, you got to have a cushion to fall back on. And then beyond that, if you want to get into gold and silver and anything, because gold and silver are great safe haven assets in a financial emergency, a financial crisis, and beyond that. And I'm a big believer in storing up emergency food and supplies for an even bigger crisis than that. But you know, initially what people are going to need, they're going to have to pay their bills. They're going to have to pay the mortgage. They're going to have to put food on the table. So don't live paycheck to paycheck, which one survey recently came out, found about two thirds of the country is living paycheck to paycheck, at least some of the time. So I guess that's my number one piece of advice, Sarah. Unfortunately, most of the country is not in that position. So just like 2008, we didn't learn our lessons. Most of the country is going to be blindsided by what's coming. And then when it does hit them, you know, a lot of people are going to lose their homes. A lot of people are going to be really hurting.
So how do we get into this predicament? I know we have all this debt and everything else, but what really happened? What did we do all these years to mess ourselves up so badly?
Yeah, well, Sarah, ultimately, if you want to go back to kind of the heart of the matter and the origin, it goes all the way back to 1913, the establishment of the Federal Reserve, where we established this debt-based financial system, which was designed, intended to create government debt, because central banks are intended to create, get governments into debt. And so then they have to impose high taxes on their populations in order to fund and service all that debt and all that big government spending. And so it's no coincidence that the same year the Federal Reserve came in, 1913, an income tax was also established. And at this point, more than 99% of the population of the entire world lives in a country with a central bank. You know, is that some kind of coincidence? You know, we can't get the entire world to agree on anything, but somehow we've gotten them all to agree on central banking. But this system, what happens is, you know, when the government wants to create new money, put new money into the system, they just don't print money and spend it into the system. Instead, they go over to the Federal Reserve and they say, hey, Federal Reserve, we'll exchange you some of these U.S. Treasury bonds, which are debt, and you print up the money and you give it to us. We'll borrow it and we'll give you the Treasury bonds, which then you auction off. You know, so basically, the government our money is coming into existence through debt, and then more debt is created always because there's interest on that debt than the amount of money that's created. But then the theory is, well, we'll circulate it through the economy really quickly and tax it at a high enough rate that we could pay back those debts. But of course, that never actually happens. Instead, this debt spiral is created where the government has to keep going back and borrowing more and more and more. And, you know, and then, you know, and what happens is that the debt just increases. And now we're at the pace where it's just increasing at an exponential rate, where now we're at $20 trillion in debt. The U.S. national debt is more than 5,000 times larger than it was than when the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. And the Federal Reserve, what it was created to do, it's actually doing a really good job of it because it's gotten us $20 trillion in debt, which is horrible. And of course, the value of the U.S. dollar has declined by more than 98%. And so if we want to, and so then we've got to tax everyone like crazy in order to fund all this. And of course, you know, our politicians love big government anyway. And so we've got all this debt just dragging all this debt and all the and this horrendous level of taxation dragging on the economy. Then, of course, regulation being overregulated, big government, all the rest of it. So fundamentally, we've got, you know, our system doesn't need just to be tweaked or patched up or reformed. We've got to completely go and rebuild it from the ground up, get rid of the Federal Reserve and establish a non-debt-based system with non-debt-based currency. You know, that it, you know, need, so the literally we need to fix our money. We need to fix our system of taxation. I just wrote an article where my position is, no, we don't need to just lower tax rates a little bit or reform the tax code, which it's 4 million words long. You know, it's this monstrosity, which is just a complete and total nightmare. We don't need to tweak that. We need to throw it in the shredder and get rid of it. I would abolish the income tax, abolish the IRS. But of course, that would require going to much more limited government, which I'm a huge advocate for anyway. But and then, you know, we need to get rid of these regulations, which are strangling our businesses. Because you know what, Sarah, I'm constantly telling people this. The greatest period of economic growth in U.S. history was between 1872 and 1913. There was no Federal Reserve. There was no income tax. There was no IRS. And what happened? Was it a disaster? No, we thrived. We saw tremendous innovation. Inventions, you know, were exploding all over the place. The U.S. economy did great, but then along comes the Federal Reserve. Since the Federal Reserve was established in 1913, we've had 18 distinct recessions and or depressions, and now we're about to go into another one. And so at some point, people have to realize what we're doing isn't working. Our system is messed up, and we've got to change. We can do it differently.
Okay, well, who do we owe this $20 trillion to? When people say we're in debt by $20 trillion, who do we owe it to?
Well, in recent years, an increasing amount of it has been bought up by foreign governments or foreigners. You know, for example, we owe more than $1 trillion to China. Japan owns a lot of it, Saudi Arabia, and the list goes on and on. So they've been buying up bigger chunks of it. Some of it is owned to essentially ourselves, where at one time, you know, we had a cushion, we had a Social Security trust fund, but now it's just filled with IOUs, you know, so it was rated to pay for other things. And so, you know, so some of it we owe to ourselves, others we owe just the bankers, investors, whoever. You know, it's such a large amount of debt, $20 trillion. And fortunately, we've been able to convince the rest of the world to buy our debt at ridiculously low interest rates, way below the real rate of inflation, and which is irrational to do. But we've been in this bubble. But if interest rates start going back up, and since Trump was elected, they have been creeping up. If interest rates were to return to the long-term average of, you know, say 5%, it's more like 6% is the long-term average, but let's just say 5%, then we'd be paying $1 trillion in interest just on the national debt, you know, before we, you know, pay for any military before we pay for any type of social programs, anything.
We'd be done. We'd just be toast if we had to do that.
And as it is right now, Sarah, I mean, we're just getting up to the $500 billion mark in interest on the national debt. But, you know, if interest rates go up to 5%, you know, $1 trillion. But already as it is, you know, we've got $500 billion of U.S. taxpayer money, which is going to nothing just to pay interest on this debt. But the big secret is we don't have to do this. Governments actually theoretically don't have to borrow money at all. We don't have to have a Federal Reserve. That, you know, the government, instead of borrowing money that the Fed creates, theoretically, the government could just create the money itself.
So could we get rid of the Federal Reserve and just wipe out that debt? Or would there be major ramifications around the world?
Well, there would be, if we tried to do it all at once, there would be major ramifications, Sarah. But what I would propose is what we do. We get rid of the Federal Reserve. You know, any essential functions they're performing, we just move into the U.S. Treasury. And then from there, go to non-based debt-based currency. And where the government's not continuing to go into more debt, and there are several ways that could be accomplished. But so we stop going into more debt on that end. And then on the other end, we still got the $20 trillion in debt. And then we slowly retire that with non-debt-based currency, which not too long ago, 1963, President John F. Kennedy issued non-debt-based United States dollars instead of Federal Reserve notes. They were United States notes. You can still go on eBay and buy these. They're collector's items. But it was non-debt-based currency not issued by the Federal Reserve. And we could do this today. And we could, start slowly paying down the national debt with non-debt-based currency. That way, it's not such a shock to the system. But you retire the debt over a long period of time. So We're going to have inflation in any circumstance. We've got inflation under the Federal Reserve, which the value of our dollars already declined by 98% since 1913. We're going to have inflation in the future, either with the Fed's program or otherwise. And so, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, why don't we just go to fiat currency immediately and let's back our currency with gold or silver or something else and go to that right away? Well, then we lock $20 trillion of debt in, based on the price of gold, which would be, you know, something very cruel to do to future generations of Americans. So what I'm an advocate of, Sarah, is we got to quit going into debt. We've got to slowly retire the debt we have, get rid of it. Eventually take it to zero, then we can go to fiat currency. What I don't want to do is impose this debt onto our children, our grandchildren, and beyond.
You mean gold-backed currency or something that's not fiat-based?
Yeah, or silver, or there's other alternatives that we can debate that. But I believe we need to have a transition to do that, because if we do it immediately, yeah, okay, we control inflation, but then we take this $20 trillion debt and say, okay, future generations, that's on you. We got into this mess, so we got to get out of it before we go to, I believe, a fiat currency and for future, because we need to get rid of this debt for future generations of Americans. Because Thomas Jefferson once said he was against government debt because it's a way for one generation to steal money from a future generation. So we've stolen $20 trillion of money from our children and our grandchildren and so on. And we continue to do so at the rate of about $100 million an hour, which is absolutely insane. So what we need to do, stop going into debt, slowly retire the debt we have with non-debt-based currency. So it's not a huge shock to the system. We need to do it gradually, get rid of the debt, then we can go to a fiat-based currency, which I would be all in favor of, and set future generations on a positive course without debt, with a strong currency moving toward the future. I just don't want to, you know, lock in that debt now and say, okay, future generations, you deal with it. We created the problem, so we've got to clean up this mess.
Do you think that we need a complete catastrophe, a full-blown economic crisis, for people to actually move in that direction? Because I find it hard for people to do something huge. A huge change like this would be hard to get people to do, especially with the money and the power that these central banks have. I mean, do we have to completely collapse and people just get sick of it and throw them out of here in order for it to happen? Because, I mean, that's how I see it. I just don't see it happening until it gets really bad. Not that it's not really bad now, but it needs to be a lot worse than it is now, I think.
I completely agree with you, Sarah, because unfortunately, well, you remember the last financial crisis, and then afterwards, we had the big end the Fed movement. People are fired up about the Federal Reserve. But today, because, you know, stock market's near record highs and things are relatively stable, people aren't quite so fired up about the Federal Reserve today. So I think it's going to take another crisis, probably worse than 2008, until people say, hey, we're sick of this. This keeps happening every 7 or 8 years or whatever. It's happening over and over again. It's the Federal Reserve. And so I think I completely agree with you. I think it's going to take a major crisis, probably worse than 2008, where people finally say, okay, this system doesn't work. There's something fundamentally wrong here. And that's why I'm pounding on this message now ahead of time, so that as we move into this time and beyond, that people are going to say, yeah, Michael, you were right. You know, this keeps happening to us. It's the Federal Reserve. It's this crazy debt-based system we have. We can't do this. We can't go into so much debt. We can't, have this cabal of central bankers, manipulating things, crashing interest rates, then raising them. We've got these booms and busts, and they're getting worse. We got to do something about this. But yeah, I think it's going to take a crisis. But hopefully after this next one, people finally realize, hey, we've got to do something.
We audited the Federal Reserve after the 2008 crisis, and there was a lot of eye-opening things on that audit. I mean, we had no idea how big of a crisis. Some people did, but the fact that there was something like $16 trillion that they gave out to different places, the $900 billion or whatever that Congress approved was peanuts compared to what was really going on behind the scenes. And we only knew that because we audited it. We haven't had the opportunity to audit it again. Now, don't you think that an audit is absolutely critical for the health of our nation?
Yeah, it should be done every year, without a doubt. And of course, I would go far beyond that and shut the Federal Reserve down as soon as possible. But, hey, if we can start with an audit on a yearly basis, that would be very, very helpful. Because, what did we find out before with a limited look into the Fed that we received? We learned that they're pumping during the financial crisis. They were just handing out trillions of dollars like candy to these too big to fail banks. Meanwhile, smaller banks were failing and they didn't help them. So essentially they played God in the financial system, deciding who would live and who would die, who gets money, who doesn't get money. This was out of the view of the American people, not subject to the democratic process, not accountable to the American people. They've been called the fourth branch of government. But, fundamentally, the Federal Reserve has more power over our economy than the president, than Congress, than anyone else in our society. And, that should disturb people.
Well, and we don't even get to see what's going on with their business sheets, with their financial forms. If we had any other institution in our country where you didn't get to see the actual finances of what was going on, it just wouldn't work. Imagine running a business and not being able to see the finances.
Oh, you're right. They operate under this cloak of secrecy. They say, we've got to be independent. Our decisions are so important. They can't be subject to the voters or the political process. But everything else in our society, whether we're going to go to war, whether, whatever else it is in our society, is subject to the political process. Oh, but the Federal Reserve, what they do is so important that it can't be. I mean, that's complete and utter nonsense. The Fed, is at the heart of our economic problems. They are so undemocratic. It's such a corrupt system. And it's got to go. And that's something that I very strongly believe in and that I'm going to very strongly advocate for.
Well, what they decide affects what we have to pay as taxpayers. And so it's not, and even if we have elected representatives, they don't get to see it either. So it's just a very unfair system for you to have to pay for decisions that not only you don't get to see, but your elected officials don't get to see.
Yeah. And so why? We need to ask a question. Why? We need to be willing to question the Federal Reserve. But, We don't hear about this from the mainstream media. Very few of our politicians question the Federal Reserve. You know, so this needs to become a political issue and part of the political debate. And we need to hear who's pro Federal Reserve, who's against the Federal Reserve. You know, who wants the system to be changed? Because ultimately, you know, if we lower tax rates a little bit, if we monkey with regulations, if we do all these other things that President Trump wants to talk about, other politicians talk about, it's not going to fundamentally fix our problems, because the heart of our problems, it's the Fed, and it's the Fed's policies and what's the Fed's been doing and how the Fed operates. Until we fix that, we're never going to fundamentally fix our economy.
Do you think that we could do it peacefully? Do you think we could change our entire money system in a peaceful manner? I mean, there might need to be a catastrophe from an economic standpoint, but does it have to get violent? I mean, can we do this peacefully?
Well, I believe so. And I'm not an advocate of violence at all. I don't want to see things get violent in our country at all. I mean, we've seen the shootings of the members of Congress where, you know, that guy took his gun out to the baseball field, tried to kill as many Republican members of Congress as he could. Fortunately, he wasn't a very good shot. And there were some, like, the Capitol Hill police were there. But, you know, our country's already on the verge of, some call it civil war, but me, I don't want to see anything of that nature ever happen. I believe that we can change peacefully. And you know what? The election of Donald Trump, whether you're pro-Trump or anti-Trump, whatever you think of Trump, he showed us that, hey, it is possible for someone who's outside the establishment, who the media hates, the establishment hates, to win the presidency. So if he can win the presidency, why can't the rest of us run for other offices and win? He showed us what's possible. And I believe that it would be possible to peacefully not change, just change the Federal Reserve, but our whole system. That ultimately we need another American Revolution, but not one with guns and bullets, but one with pen and ink and more importantly, keyboards and social media and votes and a movement of with radio and television shows like yours, Sarah, where we're in a battle for hearts and minds, one heart and one mind at a time. Maybe the show we're doing today just convinces a couple more people, helps wake them up, and where the people can understand the truth about the Federal Reserve. They can understand the truth about how our liberties and freedoms are being stripped away from us, about NSA spying, about how they're monitoring us, about, you know, why the income tax is so insidious, about why we need limited government. Because every time government gets bigger, they take more liberty and freedom away from us. And we're supposed to be the land of the free. Our founders wanted a country where freedom and liberty are maximized. So we're in an information war. And if we can win enough hearts and minds, then we start to, and part of it is, you know, hey, we've been battling this for a while, and Trump becoming president, that wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago. So we're seeing a shift. We're seeing people wake up, and it's what I do every day through my websites, through radio, through television, through all the things, my books, through all the things that we do. We're trying to win hearts and minds. But then ultimately, that's not just enough, but we need to start taking the power structures in our society. I'm talking about the legal system. I'm talking about the education system. I'm talking about media. But then I'm also talking about governmental institutions.
So with so much polarization in our country, I would think the media needs to start not – I think some of the media is incenting violence. Instead of saying, okay, it's okay that we have different ideas and we can debate them, but the whole violence stuff is out of control. Are you seeing that there's some incenting of violence that's going on in our media?
Yeah, and it's by top politicians on the left as well, but also CNN, MSNBC, and, you know, they're constantly stirring things up, stirring the pot, and using very inflammatory language. And then, you know, you've got things like this play in New York where, You know, you had this character dressed up just like Donald Trump, acting and sounding just like Donald Trump, obviously intended to be Donald Trump, and where he's viciously stabbed with blood going everywhere at the end. And, you know, it's Julius Caesar and the assassination of Julius Caesar, but he's wearing this big dark suit with the long red tie and has hair just like Trump. It's intended to be Trump. And these big media outlets, not only are they not condemning it, but then they continue to fund it. They were, they funded the whole operation, many of them, Time Warner and the New York Times and so forth. And so, you know, imagine if that was Obama, you know,
with any other president. Don't do that to somebody. I mean, we've never seen this level of disrespect to somebody in our highest office ever.
Yeah. Or Kathy Griffin holding up that, mock decapitated head of Trump that was all bloody and whatever.
Even if you don't like him, it's a sign of respect for the office, don't you think?
Oh, it is. It is. And we've seen, and it just wasn't this attack at the baseball field, but we've seen ever since Inauguration Day, this pattern of attacks on Republican lawmakers, on conservatives, on Trump supporters. So, you know, they need to be speaking out against this violence instead of constantly stirring it up, constantly fueling the hate, because, you know, these people, they're not created in a vacuum. This guy who went out and decided to shoot members of Congress, he was a big fan of Rachel Maddow, you know, apparently watched her all the time, you know, and he was, you know, and these people are who are constantly fueling the hate and that the idea that violence is okay. It's not good for our society, but ultimately, and these people are hurting their own political movement because, you know, someone like Kathy Griffin, that image is going to be burned into people's minds forever. And they're going to say, well, is this what the left is all about? Is all they have to offer anger and frustration and violence?
That's not what we're about. Because I know that if people treated Obama like this, I'd be angry. I really would be. And I think a lot of the people that didn't vote for Trump, I've heard some of my friends say, you know, I don't really like Trump, but this is not okay. And that he is our president. All we're doing is hurting ourselves by acting like this.
It is hurting because then it's going to cause people to want to look somewhere else for answers. And so, I don't see any signs that things are going to change. These people who are stirring up hatred and anger and frustration and violence, I think it's going to continue. And I think we're going to see more civil unrest, more anger, more violence. And, it's kind of a chilling time.
Well, how can we mend this? Because we have this going on, but we have a backdrop of a financial catastrophe. So we need really great leadership, I think. I mean, what is your views on how we can mend this? I mean, we have the financial, you're talking about the Fed. We're talking about all these financial issues. We're talking about alternative media having good dialogue. Is that enough to mend this?
Well, ultimately, on a fundamental level, we need to learn how to love one another. Even if we disagree, we need to learn how to love those that we disagree with. Instead, we've been trained to hate people that we disagree with, hate the politicians on the other side. But we've got to learn how to love. And that sounds so basic, but it really is what we need. And I'm about to come out with a new book in a couple of weeks, which is going to be all about this, fundamentally fixing ourselves and fixing our relationships with others and learning how to love and care about one another. And so, people want to keep an eye out for my new book about to come out in here in a couple of weeks. But ultimately, we need to change our own heart attitudes fundamentally. Now, on a broader level, we do need new leadership because, I mean, you look at Congress, Sarah. And most members of Congress, I mean, Congress has an average approval rating of about 18% right now. I mean, presidents, they're 40, 50, 60%, you know, in that range usually. But Congress, they stayed below 20% for a long time. And people are sick and tired of Congress where you've got the permanent career politicians that seem to stick around forever. And they're always, instead of serving the people who put them into office, you know, Al Franken recently came out with a book where he admitted, you know, a big part of his day, sometimes he'll spend 3 hours a day on the phone raising money for his next campaign, you know. And that's what they do. They're always concerned about, okay, raising more money. What's the next campaign? You know, schmoozing with the wealthy people and the big donors the special interests who can fund their campaigns with lots of money. And so we need to fundamentally clean up the halls of power of Congress if we're ever going to turn things around on a national level.
Well, do you think we have to get rid of this whole side stuff? And, you know, one side or the other, because realistically, there isn't two sides. I mean, it's not possible for us to have two sides. And there's so many other views, political views that are realistically out there. And I know there's a lot of movements to get more people with different views into Congress, into the Senate. And so it's not just Republican, Democrat, which is kind of a fallacy anyways, where they all vote in the same way. To me, it's a joke. There's so many different ways to view things, and we need to stop thinking of it as a game that we have them against us.
Yeah, although, you know, what we're seeing is at one time in early America, there was a consistent and a core set of values and principles that pretty much everyone agreed on. You know, there was, you know, yeah, people still had their differences, but fundamentally people viewed things in a similar manner. But today we don't have that. Instead, we see more and more of a polarization just of ideas and of concepts. And, you know, where, for example, those on the far left, if you will, they believe in big government. Government's the solution to everything. While people like myself, hey, I want to go back to what our founders intended, which was a very limited federal government, a small federal government, transferring as much power back to the states as possible, and restoring that constitutional balance of power that our founders intended, and that's the reason they put the 10th Amendment in there, for one thing, is to limit the power of the federal government. But then also, I don't want to see gigantic, enormous state governments either, because ultimately, Sarah, I guess I'm very much liberty-minded in that in America today, in the federal level, we've got hundreds of thousands of laws. But then when you throw in state, local, city, you know, all the other layers of government, you get a grand total of millions of laws, rules, and regulations. And every single law, rule, or regulation restricts our liberty and freedom in some way. It says something we have to do, something we can't do, something, you know. And so we've got these millions of laws, rules, and regulations restricting us and telling us what we have to do, what we can't do. And so that takes away our liberty and freedom. Every time there's a new government agency, every time a new rule or regulation, liberty and freedom are diminished. And so, in my opinion, we've gone swung the pendulum so far over in one direction. I want to swing it back in the other direction, where liberty and freedom are maximized, and where we try to minimize. I mean, we're always going to need some laws, and in some ways, we want our liberties and freedoms to be restricted. And I'll explain this. For example, it's good to have a law that says we can't go around randomly killing one another. We don't want the freedom to just randomly run around and murder one another. So that's a good law, you know, not to murder one another. But we want some laws, but we don't so want so much that it just suffocates our liberty and freedom to death. And that, I believe, that's where we're at today, where liberty and freedom are just being completely suffocated, and we need to swing the pendulum way back in the other direction. While those on the far left, they just want to keep making government bigger, more government agencies, more government solutions. And the more they go in that direction, the less liberty and freedom we have.
And that's all we have for today, folks. Remember to tune in on Friday, and you'll be able to hear the second part of this interview. You can also go to my website, sarahwestall.com, and hear it again. Or if you miss the second part or the first part, which you didn't miss the first part, you just heard it. But if you do, go to my website, sarahwestall.com, and you can get the interview, all parts of it, and other shows as well, where I have them all loaded onto my website and onto YouTube. From November, December on, I have them on YouTube, and then all of my shows up on my website. Remember, I have my Patreon account. If you could bless me and our listeners and contribute $2 a month, you will get my ebooks for free, which I will have another one coming out shortly. I have two at this point out. And you will also get exclusive content once I get to 100 patrons. I only have a few right now. More than a few, but not that much more. So if I can get more and get it up to 100, then I'll do some exclusive content. So please look at that as well. And for now, have an amazing day.